Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the twice weekly podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thanks so much for tuning in wherever you are in the UK and indeed around the rest of the world. And thank you all those who came to the Rock and Roll Politics live show in Birmingham on Tuesday. And by the time you listen to this, thank you to those who have been to who went to King's Place on Thursday night. I'm in Belfast on Sunday at the Black Box and at the Rope Tackle in Shoreham next Wednesday. And we'll put all the blurb with the podcast, all the details of those live events. But now, what a few days in British politics. It is quite something when a apparently mighty Prime Minister, a landslide winner in December 2019, a winner, I keep on thinking about it, of the Hartlepool by-election not so long ago, as a Prime Minister gaining a seat from Labour, appearing then, because of his electoral success, almost omnipotent in the government. And there, a lot of you I know will have watched Boris Johnson in front of the Privileges Committee fighting for his political career. It is quite an arc that we need to make sense of. And we need to make sense of it partly by making comparisons with other prime ministers. This is a chance to make sense of leadership in all its epic drama. And who better to make sense of it than Michael Cockerell, the broadcaster and author who has, as you will all know, followed closely many prime ministers, and in a way, for television, made unique sense of their lives with those glorious profiles, which included, of course, them, the leaders, watching archive of themselves and others and many other wonderful techniques. And Michael's latest book, which he'll be talking about at festivals and with us now, reflects on his whole life in which these leaders have played a big part. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Could I begin by asking you for your reflections on Boris Johnson in that select committee? We've had many other prime ministers being interrogated retrospectively, most famously Tony Blair, but here was over Iraq, but here was someone who, as I said at the beginning, December 2019, big election win, and now this. What were your thoughts?
I thought exactly that when he came into the room. This was the guy who only 2 years ago won this vast majority and was briefing for a long time thereafter that he would be in power for at least 10 years, at least until the 30s. How are the mighty fallen? And I thought the whole proceedings began like a sort of West End farce, because it began with Boris holding the St. James Bible, saying, "I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth." This is a guy who spent his whole life not telling the truth and running away from the truth. And as his former mistress, Petronella Wyatt, said about him, lying comes to him as easily as breathing. The trouble is he's not a very good liar. And so I thought it started off, you know, like a black comedy, and I think it continued to be a black comedy. Another wonderful satirical moment yesterday was when Harriet Harman, who was the chair of the Privileges Committee, or was the chair in the chair, she remembered that Boris once was the motoring correspondent for GQ, and often the people at GQ found he would write his pieces, and when they got the car back, he clearly hadn't driven it. She used this wonderful analogy when he was saying he didn't know about all these parties were going on. He had no idea all the time, even though he was at five of them. He had no idea. And someone said, "You know, didn't you look and see all the bottles on the table?" I didn't look at things like that. Miss Harman said, "If I was driving a car at 100 miles an hour and saw the speedometer said 100 miles an hour, it would be a bit odd, wouldn't it? If I said somebody had assured me that I wasn't driving at 100 miles an hour, because you'd have seen it with your own eyes." And I thought it was a devastating put down by the chair of the committee, and probably gives us some inkling of where the committee is going.
It is devastating. And of course, it would have been devastating for him because he is so unused to intensive scrutiny, isn't he? His genius, in a way, has been able to avoid much scrutiny. But you, of course, famously spent some time with him before he was leader with one of your profiles in which he said, you know, if the ball came out of the scrum or whatever.
If the ball were to come loose from the back of the scrum, it would be great to have a go at.
Yeah. So you spent some time with him then because filming is quite intensive. What was your impression of him as a person before we reflect on leadership?
Interesting. He goes really right the way back to when he was born in New York General Hospital. And his mother, Charlotte, said when he was born, he came out and he had this mop of blonde hair. And he was huge. He looked as if he was ready to go to prep school. The Beatles were in New York at exactly the same time. And all the other expectant mothers in the world went to see this new, huge, blonde-haired baby. And they called him the fifth Beatle. So there's always been this in his life that he's a sort of chosen one. He sees it himself, you know, when his sister, Rachel, who was born 18 months after him, when she was about 3 or 4, said she wanted to be world queen. And he said, you can't be world queen because I'm going to be world king. And from that moment on, he thought that the rules never applied to him. When he was at Eton, his housemaster said exactly that he feels that he should always be given special preference because he is special.
And, of course, that made the other day so powerful in a way, because finally it was catching up on him. You know, he's escaped so much. But what I wanted to explore with you, Michael, if it's okay, is that, you see, I've always had this theory, which has been greatly challenged by recent months and last year, which is actually prime ministers on the whole endure much longer than fashionable orthodoxy suggests they will. If you take when you sort of began following them closely personally, the late 60s and Harold Wilson, there was feverish speculation that he would be toppled by Roy Jenkins. He famously uttered that in the midst of a speech. You may be wondering what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. I'm going on. But the fact that he had to do it showed the feverish mood. But Wilson survived another X number of years until 76 when he voluntarily resigned. Do you think that era where prime ministers endured for much longer has gone? And they are now genuinely fragile, as Truss and Johnson has demonstrated.
Recently, prime ministers have lasted for a long time. Mrs. Thatcher lasted for a very long time. Tony Blair lasted for maybe 10 years, over 10 years, determined to do so. David Cameron, 6-7 years. So, but it suddenly speeded up from the moment of the result of the referendum. Everything has gone at warp speed with extraordinary turnover of ministers and prime ministers and so on. I think part of it is social media, that you know, in our early days as political reporters, there was a pattern of how long a story would last, but now it often doesn't last beyond an hour before it's sort of changed altogether. We don't have, and I think number 10 has been like that, especially in recent times with Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and so on. That it's, you know, almost since 2016, it's been like being chained to a lunatic, whilst this kind of speed that has been going on.
Do you think it is more underlying events that Brexit has unleashed various kind of volcanic eruptions that would challenge a prime minister of titanic strength? Or has Brexit thrown up people who are unsuitable for the demands of leadership? We've had Theresa May She didn't last very long. Liz Truss, famously, you wouldn't have even had time to do a profile of Liz Truss.
Exactly, the letters would have gone off already.
And then we've had Johnson. I mean, you have met and known a range of prime ministers. Are these, irrespective of where people stand politically, are these just people who were unsuitable compared to some of the others that you knew for the demands of leadership?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think Boris Johnson certainly falls into that category, partly because he was different from almost from all other prime ministers, because he was the great entertainer. You know, he was Archie Rice in The Great Entertainer at the start, but somehow the act has gone cold on him. And even yesterday, you know, here was Boris, the guy who had so many of the skills of political communication and getting over to much of the country, and partly he did it by jokes. And Boris had to sit there yesterday for 3.5 hours without telling any jokes. It was, you know, Hamlet without the Prince of Denmark.
Yeah, it's an interesting contrast. There he was on television in front of a big audience to compare it with when he presented Have I Got News For You? And the contrast is extraordinary, isn't it? And, of course, it was the Have I Got News For You, Johnson, that a lot of people seemed to fall for.
Yes, which made the editor of Private Eye often feel guilty that Have I Got News For You sort of propelled Johnson into the public eye and probably helped him becoming a Tory leader.
It is easy from that to conclude that the showbiz prime ministers might not survive very long, that in the end you get found out quite quickly.
You get found out and you suffer career fatigue. That it's like when box sets come out and people go through them, the whole thing, all six episodes, you know, over the evening.
Go.
Exactly. Everything is speeded up like that.
Yeah. But one of the things that I mean, it's quite depressing that someone can rise on the back of a performance and Have I Got News For You. But I also think it's quite interesting that some of the prime ministers who are very different from the Johnson model were emphatically not showbiz and were mastery of detail and on top of their briefs. I'm thinking of people like Edward Heath, who I know you knew, and Gordon Brown. They too did not last very long, did they?
They too didn't last very long, mainly because part of leadership is you have to have a certain amount of charisma. And it's not just the sort of showbiz charisma. There are certain people that you take to straight away when you meet them, and certain people you don't. And so, some of them, people say, you know, he's his own worst enemy. No, I'm his own worst enemy of these people. And you take an instant dislike to them. It saves time, they say. And there was poor old Ted. I remember he once said to me, I've been thinking about you. Do you have any training for this? I said, no, none at all. I sort of parodied what I said. I never read anything, never do any homework or anything like that, in the opposite of what I actually do. And he said, oh, well, that would account for it. Do you have the usual list of boring questions, he said. And I said, we did the interview, and I said, which went a bit better than usual. I said, did you think the questions were as boring as usual? He said, oh, yes, but infinitely more irrelevant today. And his PR man said afterwards, if he's rude to you, it means he likes you.
It makes you wonder how someone like him got to the very top, wasn't it? I mean, he was the first leader to be elected by Tory MPs.
Exactly.
And he clearly wasn't one to charm. Or maybe, I mean, could he charm? I never met him. Could he?
He could charm. He did have a certain black sense of humour. But he was very introverted about it. Of course, he was chosen because it was thought that he would be the guy who could stand up to Harold Wilson on television. Harold Wilson was the first sort of TV prime minister. He was the first one who understood really what television could do for a leader. And it was thought that Heath would be able to stand up to him on television. Also, in the 60s, when he was chosen as leader, things were changing. There'd been three old Etonian Tory prime ministers and an old Harrovian in a row. Wilson was a grammar school boy, and Ted Heath was a grammar school boy. So that was in it. They were already thinking of the image of the what is needed in a prime minister to beat an incumbent.
Yeah, and Heath had been a formidable cabinet minister, actually, hadn't he? Under various
and led us into Europe.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, I was speaking to a very senior Labour figure about some of this, and that this person, very young, but had looked back and thought Heath was an extraordinarily talented figure. But anyway, he didn't last very long. Gordon Brown, it's interesting because he could have charisma, but he almost chose not to, from the moment he became Shadow Chancellor, to become that robotic figure. So fearful was he of uttering a word out of place. But his arc was extraordinary because it was a huge triumph, in my view, to be such a long-serving Labour Chancellor, breaking all records on that front. But then he didn't last long in number 10.
Yeah, and of course, in his own mind, one of the reasons he didn't show this private charisma was he didn't want to look like Tony Blair. He publicly disliked or what he saw as Tony Blair's sort of entertainment spin doctoring going on, that kind of image making. He publicly said he didn't like. Behind the scenes, his people were all the time trying to get him to do things which would relate more to ordinary people. But he was always defining himself in opposition to Tony Blair, and had spent 10 years as Chancellor in opposition to Tony Blair, not even telling him what was in the budget until the day of the budget.
It's interesting, isn't it, the amount of time these highly intelligent, driven people do spend reflecting on how, it's understandable, how they will be perceived. I mean, I saw Neil Kinnock the other night, and he, even though he's over 80, is back to his exuberant self that he was before he became Labour leader. But then in between, he attempted to appear like a sober bank manager, didn't he? So let's in that context, return to where we are now. I'll ask you about Sunak in a moment. But Boris Johnson, he thinks he's Churchill. I'm sure he feels bruised today because I think there's an element, a small element of self-awareness in him. I don't know whether you agree with that. Maybe you think there is none. But do you? Is it your sense that yesterday we saw the power finally seeping away altogether, having been removed in the summer of last year, this was the final ending? Or do you sense that there is a Churchillian resilience in him that means he could bounce back?
The power that he has had for a long time, especially in the Tory party, is because of Brexit and all that. But if he can't get more than 22 people to rebel with him, how will he get more than, hundreds of people to support him when he comes really up against it?
And again, it does show how things move, isn't it? I mean, it was only last September when he attempted that comeback.
Yes.
And apparently did manage to secure the support of over 100 MPs before withdrawing. I mean, yes. but it looks as if it's gone now, doesn't it?
I felt it was draining away throughout that hearing. And I think he still sees himself as Churchill. And he wrote a famous biography of Churchill, which showed how Churchill had spent his career, like Boris, he'd been a journalist and so on, and was in the wilderness and so on. And it showed how in Boris's book, Churchill had modelled his career on that of Boris Johnson, but it may have been the other way around.
Yes, occasionally you read like a sort of autobiography or a sort of fantasy of an autobiography. And where does this place Rishi Sunak? Because he's the prime minister you know least of all the ones you've been following since the 60s.
Yes, he hasn't been prime minister for that long either. I know him a bit. I think he's been having for the last few weeks a series of good weeks, both around the world and with the renegotiation of the protocol and so on. And he kind of looks he's a tiny chap. He's about 5'6", but he looks a bigger man than Boris Johnson in terms of the way he's behaved as prime minister. He looks like one of the grown-ups in the room. Don't underestimate him. He at one stage, when he'd resigned from Boris's cabinet, which had helped bring down the downfall of Boris, he thought he was going to go back up to his constituency in Yorkshire and play for the local village cricket team. And from the picture of him in the papers today and playing cricket in number 10, he looks like a rather elegant batsman.
The glasses help. Isn't it funny? What makes someone leaderly is an interesting question. And he has started to look leaderly. It's partly because, as you say, he's had good weeks. And then people start to see leaders in a different light. And do you remember at the beginning, people say, oh, he hasn't got a political bone in his body and so on. But because he's had a few successes, perceptions can change.
Yeah, the glasses thing is a very interesting one because for over the years, it's been the other way around. You remember Jack Straw took off his glasses when he wanted to be seen as a potential prime minister. And prime ministers themselves hated to be seen with glasses. Tony Blair wore glasses a lot of the time privately, but he didn't want to be seen because it's that intimation of mortality.
We've explored some elements of leadership, the capacity for detail, people like Heath and Brown, the showbiz element. Of course, Wilson had a bit of a showbiz element, but he could do the detail as well. You've met and spent time with all of them. Have you got any sense of the essential qualifications for leadership, the essential characteristics?
I think you've got to really want to do something. You want to change the world. You want to make the weather, that you have a set of core beliefs that you can fall back on when the going gets rough. I think that's really important. You have to know, especially in this modern world, how to communicate, how to get your message across, but not through spin, but because it's something you believe and you can articulate and people can relate to. I mean, one of the interesting things is, say, compared to my time at university many years ago, many people want to go into politics, whereas I think these days many of the brightest and best go into the media. And if you have the politicians who are less bright than their critics, the critics are able to be even more devastating than their fellow MPs. So it's an interesting change that's been going on.
And it's interesting as well, you obviously did go into the media, but were hooked on politics. And your book, I'm Asking Our Leaders, is about your sort of life almost in politics. When did you hit upon the idea that there was space, even on television, which it's difficult on television, to go deeper into what makes up a leader? And that thing you do of showing them archive of themselves and others. I mean, when did it all begin as an idea for you?
That's very interesting. I suppose it, It sort of began when I was first up at Oxford, when Harold Macmillan was Prime Minister and had just won a huge majority of over 100 in 1959. And he came and spoke at the Oxford Union, and he was so kind of charismatic as well as fascinating when he talked about fighting in the trenches in the First World War and how his group at Balliol, his classics, who were all reading classics, how all but one of them were killed in the First World War. And he had a sense of what suffering was like and what ordinary working class people were like in the trenches. He'd sort of learned that. And so he was very different from a traditional Tory. And I just thought then, wouldn't it be fascinating to make films? Wouldn't it have been fascinating to make films about Gladstone and Disraeli? We know what they look like. There's a very small, scratchy recording of Gladstone's voice in the 1890s, but that's it. But what was their body language? How would they have dealt with television? All that kind of thing. And one of the things of showing them, the modern prime ministers themselves on television, is that they look at themselves and they're suddenly transported back to their prime. I remember Jim Callaghan saying, when he saw some, I showed him this footage of him in 1947 when he was a very junior traffic minister. And he said, what a promising young man. I wonder whatever happened to him. It sparks in the memories of what they were thinking about at the time. I remember Ken Clark, when I made a film about Kenneth Clark, and he said, how do you want me to play this? I said, well, I'll be showing you this footage. We've been digging out stuff which you've probably never seen, because most leaders and prime ministers and ministers have strong views about television, but scarcely had the time to watch it. And certainly in the earlier days, there weren't DVDs or anything, iPlayers to watch it on. I said, so I'll show you these clips, some of which you've probably not seen before, and just I want you to react naturally. And he said, you mean you want me to sit here and shout at the television like I do at home? I said, you've got it in one.
Have you got, and your archive is part of history now. I mean, it will be used as source material. But have you got a favourite of your films, profiles, one that you thought, wow, this really does show another side to a complex leader?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hope that in a way, almost all of the ones when I had proper access, say, for instance, when I filmed for about 3 months in 2000 behind the scenes in Number 10 with Blair and Campbell and Peter Mandelson, where we really showed what was going on with the spin operation there. That was one which I was very happy about and seemed to get down well.
They gave you complete access, didn't they?
Yeah, it was partly because Alistair Campbell thought that the Tories were making so much of spin, exactly as Labour had been making of Tory sleaze, that if I could show what was really going on behind the scenes in terms of the amount of information that a government has to get out every day, not spun, but just if you have three, four big stories on the same day, it clash. So some of it is not as evil as it might seem with the spin doctors. I remember one day Peter Mandelson glid up to me, whatever the bastard glide is. I'm sure you know this. I was sort of talking to people at a party and suddenly I was aware of a sudden sort of chill in the air. And there was Peter Mandelson who'd got to my shoulder and he said, you do the most important thing you can do for a politician, Michael. I said, what's that, Peter? He said, you make them appear human. And then glid away. just as I was about to say, might be difficult with you, Peter, but he was gone, leaving only the faintest whiff of sulfur.
To glide is, the verb to apply that. Absolutely. These are human beings. And of course, that makes them more interesting. People forget that if column writers who just stick to a stereotype, it's an easy column to write. But actually, they're more interesting when you remember they are human beings facing nightmarish dilemmas on an hourly basis. I mean, that is the basis of it, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about other films. I mean, I did make films with Margaret Thatcher, and I remember saying to her, so it was in 1979, during the general election of 79, that I've been following you during this election campaign, and there sometimes seem to me to be two Mrs. Thatchers. One is the one on the campaigning on the factory floor and walkabouts in the streets and talking to ordinary people, endlessly interested in the minutiae of their lives. And the other is the one on the conference platform, full of passionate rhetoric. How many Mrs. Thatchers are there? And she said in her newly lowered voice, which she been given lessons to bring down the tone of her voice. She said, "Oh, three at least." I said, "Really? What are the three?" She said, "There's the intuitive one, there's the intellectual one, and there's the one at home." And she said it in such a seductive way that people thought there must be something going on between her and me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Robin Day. Oh. Robin Day actually, who was watching it going out in the studio, didn't say publicly, but in the studio, said, "The untold story of the 79 election, Margaret Thatcher's having an affair with Michael Cockerell."
that would have been a big story, Michael. But interesting, there's a book to be written on her analysis of the three Margaret Thatchers that you got her to talk about, which highlights the value of the work that you do. And you'll be talking about your book in Oxford on Wednesday, the Oxford Literary Festival, Wednesday afternoon, with clips, I gather.
Yes, some of which haven't been seen before.
Oh, really? So a guided tour of these just wonderful, humanizing documentaries, but humanizing, it still brings out flaws. I mean, it's not hagiographic, but it brings out the complexities, which have been brilliant. And thank you very much for joining us for the podcast in this extraordinary period where, once again, Johnson looms, but has Sunak escaped this period of the ERG group, Johnson Truss, and so on? Or will he still be partly defined by it? Perhaps that will be one of the themes the Rock and Roll Politics podcast cooperative will be reflecting on in coming days. But thank you, Michael, and thank you all for tuning in. Let's get together again very soon to make sense of it all. Thank you. Bye.